Hello and welcome to Pod Rights. This is a series of podcasts from the Australian Human Rights Commission. I'm Graham Innes, the Disability Discrimination Commissioner. Most episodes of Pod Rights deal with a human rights issue in Australia or an activity in which the Australian Human Rights Commission has been involved. But this Pod Rights is different. We're going to talk with someone who's had experience on the human rights front line overseas. Not at meetings or at conferences to discuss human rights, but actually carrying out practical work in the broad human rights area. My guest today is Amy Lemoine. Amy's been a member of staff at the Australian Human Rights Commission. In fact, she worked as a senior policy officer in the race team for almost 6 years and worked with me when I was race discrimination commissioner, as well as several other commissioners. Amy has also worked as a policy officer at the Queensland Anti-Discrimination for 3 years. Queensland Anti-Discrimination Commission for 3 years. So quite a bit of experience in the human rights area in Australia. So welcome to Pod Rights, Amy.
Thanks, Graham. Good to be here.
But it's not that work that I want to talk about today. Several years ago, Amy worked as a technical advisor for the UN Human Rights, the UN High Commissioner on Human Rights on the Thai-Burma border. And she's recently returned to Australia after some work in Liberia as a child protection specialist, focusing on child protection in emergency situations for about 7 months. And it's those activities that we're going to discuss today. So firstly, Amy, let's get some background. What prompts your passion for human rights issues, particularly issues relating to discrimination on the basis of race? What brought you into that area in the first place?
I've always had a very strong interest in that particular content area. For me, so much inequality actually does relate to race, whether we realise that or not, and that was my particular perspective. I'd spent a lot of time in Queensland working on issues that relate to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander communities, and that's where I really started a lot of my core work around equality and anti-discrimination. I very much enjoyed that. I'd done some work previous to that on refugee policy, and very strongly came to adopt that in terms of my broader perspective as something that actually underpins broader inequality and that links up to other forms of inequality. And so that became, I guess, my core area of work very early on.
And is that what led you to the work that you did on the Thai-Burma border for the UNHCR? Are those two linked, or was that sort of a separate passion?
I see it as, I guess, certainly very closely related. I think that it's easy sometimes, particularly for Australians more broadly, to forget that underneath issues that relate to refugees, alongside with a whole number of factors like irregular migration, poverty, issues around development, there's also a factor of race in there, and that sometimes it's easy for us to not fully consider this issue. And sometimes I think that's because we overlook the factor of race, or we're prepared to overlook the issue of race.
So tell me about, firstly, your preparation for working for the UNHCR. You did a lot of training, or a number of training courses for that, didn't you?
I did. I did a lot of training in Australia and was deployed through an Australian register to go and work for the UNHCR. And I think though that training is incredibly useful, there's certainly no substitute for actually being in the field, and that's where you really find your human rights legs, if there was any such thing. You spend time in communities and start to learn very quickly to sit quietly and listen to the expertise that comes from refugee communities themselves. You know, all members of communities, children living in those communities, parents, you know, elders, aged members of those communities. That's where your expertise will come from. It comes directly from those people who have an acute understanding of their own situation and who have over a course of years.
But that's the same in Australia, isn't it? I mean, if you're going to develop good human rights policy in Australia, it's got to be community-based, and you need to go and sit and listen to communities and what they're saying. There must have been some huge differences, though, trying to translate the policy skills that you develop, the listening skills, the reflection of what's happening in communities, what they're saying, and translating that into policy. There must have been some huge differences going and doing that on the Thai-Burma border for the UNHCR.
There are huge differences, and there are enormous similarities at the same at the same time. So the similarities are that you require all the same listening skills. You need to spend a lot of time listening and not just talking, which is incredibly important. I actually arrived with very little country knowledge.
Right.
So you have to spend some time, and luckily I'd done that working at the Australian Human Rights Commission, developed good skills in terms of cross-cultural sensitivity, and can very quickly get across information that relates to people's culture or cultures, their cultural values and beliefs. So that was an important skill set that I'd already developed and that I certainly used on a daily basis in Mae Sot on the Thai-Burma border, where incidentally there's one of the largest refugee camps with, I think, around 30,000 people who've lived there over decades. There are some people in Mae La camp who have actually never left. They're ethnically Burmese, have always lived on the Thai side of the Burma, Thai side of the Thai-Burma border, and there were discussions then, and there are ongoing discussions about actually closing a number of those refugee camps now that there are changes. What's been named as more positive changes in Burma. But obviously there are issues about people being able to return safely, and then also issues of people having livelihoods and family connections once they returned.
And these are adults who were born in these camps and have never lived anywhere else?
Yes, so there are some people who have been born in those camps and actually have no connection to Burma beyond their existing family networks within the camps and their community networks within the camps.
What were you actually doing for the UNHCR?
So I was a protection officer, and I spent most of my time in camps doing human rights monitoring. So you're actually talking to community members about emerging issues. You're considering safety in those camps, you're looking at gender issues and safety of women, you spend some time considering children and their situation, and you're essentially reporting back to the UNHCR. And at that time we were doing a lot of work around potential camp closures, and doing work with communities around that, so essentially trying to have some fairly sensitive conversations about potential closures and what that actually means for the beneficiaries or for people who've been living in a number of camps along the border.
And safety was a real issue in the camps, wasn't it?
Safety is always a real issue in the camps, and largely that's just the upshot of having groups of people who have generally experienced profound stress or living in one close area with fairly poor services and issues around food security and ongoing stress.
And you were there for a number of months?
I was there for 4 months.
What were some of the things that you brought away from that experience? What were some of the lessons that you brought away from that experience that I suppose strengthen your human rights knowledge, your policy knowledge, and where was your sense of what our chances are of positive practical change in places like these camps after that time?
I guess part of what I learned in that situation, and again what I learned in Liberia, was some of the difficulties in relation to negotiating the mandate between United Nations agencies. So there's sometimes conflict in relation to mandate, or there's, I guess, mandate overlap or mandate creep that can be difficult to resolve right from the start. So, for example, the question will often arise, and it's an age-old question, and I'm surprised that we don't have a better answer, and oftentimes we don't. Of course, it depends on the specific country situation, but around who has primary responsibility, for example, for refugee children. Is it UNICEF? Is it the UNHCR? So there can be some difficulties and tensions sometimes in trying to resolve that question, which obviously has really practical operational implications around how we actually conduct our responsibilities, how we actually, you know, what we're actually doing in the field, who takes lead. So that's always an interesting thing to try and manage, and not necessarily a very easy thing to manage from a practical perspective. I think, again, I would stress the importance of the learnings from or listening to the communities themselves directly, because they have that acute sense of their own safety, and people in communities will have a far more sound and current knowledge of potential threats and issues and instability well before any UN agency, I think. So actually being connected enough to community to have the right kind of information to be able to carry out your work in an effective way is critical. And I guess that's no different from, it's possibly more acute, but no different from how I've worked in Australian contexts, where that level of connection to community will actually make you, assist you to have better information and help you carry out your responsibilities much more effectively and do much more targeted work.
And at a higher level, I mean, people in Australia are well aware of the way that asylum seekers and refugees are viewed here, and sadly it's in a pretty negative way. Is that an experience that you see reflected in other countries, Thailand and African countries where you've worked?
Sadly, it is, and I think particularly on the Thai-Burma border, there are a number of issues at play, and one of those issues is that there are still parts of Thailand that are impoverished, even though it's a country that's in a state of strong economic transition. There are obviously parts of Thailand in great poverty. Liberia is one of the poorest countries in the world, and certainly in the four counties that that were hosting refugee communities from the Ivory Coast, those counties were the poorest in Liberia. So what you see is essentially host communities already under enormous stress, then trying to actually support refugee communities. I would think that, you know, in Liberia, I can say with confidence, there's genuine goodwill between the Liberian communities and refugees for the most part. There was genuine cooperation from most Liberian people, even though they had so few resources to share, and it really compounded the existing stress in that community. The Thai government, I think, sometimes was really responding to a level of intolerance in Thailand around Burmese refugees, and certainly Burmese migrant workers as well, and would occasionally, when there was enough public pressure, governments would go out and identify illegal migrant workers and asylum seekers and essentially detain them and then send them back across the border without due regard, from my view, for their broader overall safety.
Well, let's turn now to Liberia, because you've talked about it a little bit. What were you actually doing there? What work were you doing in Liberia?
So I was a child protection specialist working in the child protection in emergencies team. It was a very, very small team, and we were responding essentially to the humanitarian emergency, which really was Ivorian refugees, around 160,000 Ivorian refugees who last year had moved across the border because of unrest in the Ivory Coast, and essentially for the most part had moved across into four counties, and as I just mentioned, the poorest in Liberia. So then a series of kind of compounding issues. So you had refugees both in the camps themselves that were established, and then in host communities as well.
Right. So you weren't talking about long-term issues there in the same way that you were on the Thai-Burma border, because most of those people had moved just last year, but there must have been a whole lot of other impacts of displacement and dispossession and et cetera, et cetera.
Absolutely, and we had I had a specific focus on child protection. So we, though I will say, I guess, that in any humanitarian emergency, it's ideal to build in some element of sustainability so that there are actually systems in place to respond to an emergency. But also, for example, in West Africa, there's not necessarily a foster care system. So you essentially, at the same time as you're responding to a humanitarian emergency, are trying to, at a systems level, respond to issues within Liberia more broadly. And it's something that you have to balance, because there you can actually create enormous issues for both refugees and the host community if a lot of energy and resources are poured into supporting refugees when the broader community is so incredibly poor.
Of course.
You can actually then put refugees themselves at risk.
At risk, yeah.
So a lot of activities like like, you know, looking at foster care arrangements, grave violations of children's rights, looking at child soldiers, and child soldiers was a major issue for Liberia, and continues to be, as child soldiers during the civil war there are now in their, you know, late teens, early 20s, they've had no real support in terms of broader psychosocial support or mental health support, and there's no secondary education and very limited livelihood opportunities. So you've got a group of essentially disengaged young people, which of course in terms of the long-term peace of the country, it puts that at risk in a very serious way when you've got such a big group of disengaged young people who've had no access to education.
Many of us working at the Commission here are passionate about human rights and the work that we do. I know that you were when you worked here, but we're doing that in a developed country like Australia, with a strong economy and good living conditions. You've really taken it to another level. Why did you choose to do that work in countries where the situation is so different as you've described it?
I think it's incredibly important to spend time in the field. I think that that it only strengthens any more work that I will be doing at home. That when governments in developed countries like Australia make arguments about refugees jumping queues, and they make various arguments about the experiences of refugees, that being able to test that thinking in a critical way through practical experience in the field and through understanding what profound stress, for example, really means for refugees and for refugee families and communities. Understanding how we should be responding to profound stress to ensure that essentially, you know, refugees in Australia go on to get support so that they can become safe and at home and contributing members of Australian society is really critical. And that you can, that actual work in the field and that time in the field gives you that really grounded, rich knowledge to be able to go on and kind of test that thinking both in developing contexts and in developed contexts. And I think, I mean, it's also interesting having the experience of working in some of those countries where governments, even though they have a limited technical ability and limited resources, governments like the government of Liberia, they are so eager and so committed to working with the United Nations to try and produce good outcomes, not just for Liberians, but for refugees living on their side of the border. And the generosity that comes, you know, at a community level from Liberians who are incredibly impoverished but are prepared to share land to help try and grow food for their Ivorian neighbours, even though there are language gaps, with Liberians speaking English and Ivorians obviously being French speakers. That level of generosity, which I think sometimes is really missing in Australia, and I think that's incredibly sad.
Is that what's... I mean, you have such circumstances of difficulty, poverty, other problems. Are those the sorts of things that sustain you to be able to continue to try and make a difference? What is it that allows you to focus on making a difference rather than just to sort of say this is just too hard?
There are certainly some days when it feels too hard,
yeah.
I think.
Yeah.
And I think it's about... what I learned very well in Australia and largely through my work with Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islanders, looking at community leaders from that community, I think being good at working incrementally and understanding that change only happens so incredibly slowly, and being realistic about the change that we are able to create, whether it's the Australian Human Rights Commission or the United Nations, that we really support communities to create their own change, that it's not necessarily us that are leading, and where we do lead, we lead in collaboration with a range of other people, and it's largely communities themselves.
Yeah.
I think that's a very important thing. And so finding your right space and a comfortable space to support other people's voices is the most useful role that I've been able to play. And I guess actually just being exposed to the level of complexity and difficulty of some people's lives, it does motivate you to just keep going to work, and it does give you a really sharp perspective in terms of how lucky I am and how much better we could be doing, I think, in Australia.
In Australia, yeah. Yeah, it's interesting when you talk about the generosity of people in Liberia as compared to here, and it's fascinating to make those sorts of comparisons, isn't it?
It is, and most, you know, most, it's really important to keep in mind that in terms of people that are receiving asylum seekers, mm-hmm. a majority of you know, receiving countries are developing countries, and it's important to keep that in mind. They are least resourced, and their governments have the, you know, least technical capacity to be able to respond, and yet there is a level of generosity there.
So the Thai-Burma border, Liberia, what's next for Amy Lemoine?
I'm not entirely sure. I think a little break, and then possibly another deployment to a humanitarian emergency. I think it's important to have something that UNICEF has taught me very well is that it's important to have very strong work-life balance so that you can go back out into the field with a good sense of perspective. That's the only thing that will ever make you useful. It's easy to lose perspective, and it's easy to work from a very tired space. It doesn't necessarily make us very useful, though. So a short break followed by potentially another deployment.
Well, excellent. It's great to talk with you. I think there's some real lessons to hear from someone who's had the experience that you have, and I'm very admiring of your capacity to just keep going out and doing in those sorts of really difficult circumstances. So thanks for the opportunity to talk with you on Podrights today.
Thanks, Graham.
Okay, thanks Amy, and thanks to all who've been listening to Podrights. Remember, this podcast is for you, so if you have a suggestion of someone with whom I should talk or a comment on the podcast, please email me at podrights@humanrights.gov.au or find me and message me on Facebook or Twitter. Just search for Graham Innes, GraeMeInnes. Also, if you want to engage more on human rights issues, have a look at tellmesomethingidontknow.gov.au, our Something in Common project, where you can read fascinating human rights facts and stories, participate in polls, add your own content, and find out what you can do to advance human rights issues in Australia. And keep your podcatchers ready for the next Podrights in the series, because human rights are for everyone, everywhere, every day. I'm Graham Innes. Goodbye for now.